KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Santa Clara.
I'm from Fremont.
Pacifica, California.
Pleasanton.
Coming up, the housing units planned for Hunters Point Shipyard make up the city's biggest redevelopment project, but new documents reveal almost all the cleanup data is unreliable.
There's been allegations and actual falsifications of data elsewhere at Hunters Point.
Then backpackers on the Pacific Crest Trail run into something unexpected.
There's a chocolate cake that you can't even imagine on the trail.
And from San Francisco StoryCorps, a reflection on dealing with trauma during the Santa Rosa wildfire.
They put out like a call for like, if you have training to help people through like trauma and crises, we really need you. And I'm driving away, like it was so hard.
That's coming up next today on Cross Currents. The Shipyard. It's supposed to be San Francisco's biggest redevelopment project since the 1906 earthquake. It's slated to have affordable housing, office and retail space, and parks. But this year, the shipyard development has been infamously dubbed the biggest case of eco-fraud in U.S. history. The cleanup of the former naval base and nuclear testing lab has been plagued by scandal, whistleblowers, and cover-ups. Earlier this year, a review revealed that almost all the data on toxic cleanup was unreliable. There are plans to retest much of the site, and residents and activists want to make sure that also applies to the parcels where people are currently living right now. So the California Department of Public Health has started scanning those areas for radiation, but is it enough? We're joined now by KALW's environment reporter Angela Johnston for more. Hi, Angela.
Hi.
So bring us up to speed. You were just at the shipyard. What did you see?
Yeah, so they started what they're calling scans, radiation scans, last week on July 16th. And I went to check it out on Wednesday, and when I pulled up, I saw about half a dozen people, some dressed in bright green safety vests, slowly walking up and down the sidewalk and parks and roads, and they're holding what look like these beige-colored lunch boxes with these knobs and dials on them. And in the other hand, they have this long metal tube about the size of a paper towel roll, and it's hanging from a rope, and they're swinging that back and forth over the pavement and the grass. Mm-hmm. So the lunchbox-looking machine is called a sodium iodide detector. There's this chemical, sodium iodide, in the tube, and if there are gamma rays underneath the soil, underneath the pavement, they pass through the sodium iodide and produce light. And the light is then converted to an electronic signal that's pretty audible.
You can hear it?
You can hear it. It's kind of like a Geiger counter, if you can picture what that sounds like, but a little different.
Okay, so what does it sound like?
Well, before I play the clip, as you may already know, there's background radiation around us all the time. Mm-hmm. You get radiation when you sleep next to somebody, or when you eat a banana, or when you fly in a plane, or just walking around your neighborhood.
Just living life.
Yeah, there's background radiation. So the sound I heard when they're just walking around with the scanner, it was picking up background radiation.
It sounds creaky. So that's kind of the normal sound of us just living.
That's the normal sound. And it does sound like, that doesn't sound great to me.
No,
first.
It doesn't.
It's kind of a scary sound. But again, this is just what it sounds like with background radiation. That's
okay,
normal.
So that's baseline.
That's baseline. Mm-hmm. California Department of Public Health took me down to one of the trailers they had set up on site, and they calibrate these sodium iodide detectors with a contained source of radiation. So they showed me what the detection of radiation would actually sound like if they came across a spot.
It's a different pitch. It's very high.
Yeah, it is. It's a higher pitch. It's, you know, the frequency is faster.
Yeah.
So they'll be doing this scanning for the rest of the month, and they're going to be listening for that change. And they're also towing a bigger scanner attached to the back of an ATV over some of the areas, too.
Okay. And what happens if they detect something?
Right. When I visited Hunters Point, I spoke with Dr. Mark Starr. He works for the California Department of Public Health, and here's what he told me.
If we find something, we'll do thorough investigation at that spot. Additional scanning, it's called static scanning, and we'll pinpoint where the radiation is coming from in the soil, and we'll also be able to determine what the isotope is, and if it's natural or man-made.
And so if it's man-made, which means it was something that the Navy used a long time ago back in their days there, mm-hmm. it'll need to be removed. And so they'll dig it up, remove it, and then, of course, they'll probably test the areas around that spot, too, and take soil samples around to make sure there's everything else is clean.
Okay. So this area was tested before, though.
Right. I was curious about that, too. It was released to the city from the Navy back in 2004. So the California Department of Public Health says it did go through a scan by the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, back then. Mm-hmm. But I asked Dr. Starr the same question, and here's what he said.
There's been allegations and actual falsifications of data elsewhere at Hunter's Point. This particular parcel hasn't been implicated in those, but there's still been some concerns, and there's been some whistleblowers that said there might have been a problem here. And so all the agencies involved wanted to make sure, especially because there's people living here.
I mean, yes, there are people living there. What do these people think?
That's where it continues to get a little bit complicated. The actual residents are less vocal about it than the Bayview Hunters Point community activists. So there's a group of people who have bought the condos and the apartments that are on Parcel A. And then there's people who just live in the surrounding community, who have been there for a long time, have seen the shipyard change. And so one of the biggest issues is trust. Mm-hmm. They feel like they've been duped and lied to and excluded from the process so many times before. And you keep hearing this news, like scandal at Hunter's Point. New data reveals that it might be falsified. So they're just skeptical about the entire process. And it's hard for them to believe whatever somebody says.
It's hard to gain that trust. What are they talking about mostly? What are their main concerns?
Well, one big one is they feel they were left out of the process early on, especially this testing of Parcel A. Mm-hmm. The California Department of Public Health only put out their plan 10 days before they started testing. And Bradley Angel, he works for Green Action, an environmental justice group that's been fighting with the residents of the shipyard for a while. In an email, he expressed some of their big concerns. He mm-hmm. says there was no official comment period, no transparency. And I brought that to Dr. Starr at California Department of Public Health. And here's his response.
It is a very open process. We wanted to get this done on behalf of the residents as quickly as possible and get started early. So we balanced that with having the plan available publicly for about 10 days beforehand. There's no strict public comment period for this one. It's really just we're just being open and accepting suggestions as they come in.
And I should mention that the California Department of Public Health had a table outside with someone sitting at it in the middle of the development, the middle of this testing process. And there was someone there. He was answering questions and handing out flyers.
Okay.
Another huge concern is that this is just a scan of publicly accessible areas. They aren't doing soil samples, and they aren't testing inside of people's homes.
Why?
Well, that's the question that Michelle Pierce had, and a lot of residents and activists have. She grew up in the Bayview, and she's part of the Bayview Hunters Point Community Advocates. It's another environmental justice group. And we met at a little coffee shop and cafe right below the development on Parcel A. Here's what Michelle had to say.
How is that of benefit to the people who are actually living on this property? Or if you ever get a chance to visit any of the apartments behind us, they all have like courtyards and open spaces and patios that you might want to hang out on. And that's not readily technically publicly accessible, right? These are for tenants. How do they know that that is safe?
Good question.
Yeah, and I asked that to California Department of Public Health. And they basically said the scanning of the outdoor surface areas will get of results most efficiently. They said they'll be able to do it pretty quickly and they'll be done by this month. And they also said that the material that they find there will be very similar to what may be present below residences. So if they don't find anything there, they can safely assume that there probably won't be anything below residences. It still leaves some questions. But, you know, another thing they said is they want to balance actually doing something for the residents without disturbing the soil, without ripping up concrete, mm-hmm. and that will just get it done quickly. They'll be finished by the end of the month, they think.
So when will we know the findings?
Well, results will be formalized and written up later this summer or early fall, but there should be periodic updates this month to residents. That's what California Department of Public Health told me. They say it'll be available on their website, and I'll put a link to that. We'll be sharing that updates on KLW's social media.
Great. Thank you, Angela.
Thank you.
Angela is KELW's environment reporter. You can reach her at environment@kelw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Right now, there are backpackers crossing into Canada after 5 months of hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. They're called thru-hikers. They started the trail in Mexico and traversed 2,650 miles. Now, the lazy among us might have just read Wild, Cheryl Strayed's memoir about the Pacific Crest Trail, but the hikers, their toenails fall off and their feet can swell whole shoe sizes. But they say the only thing they talk about more than their feet is food. For the podcast California Foodways, KELW's Lisa Morehouse reports from the trail in a tiny corner of Alpine County.
This is a story about the Pacific Crest Trail, but it actually starts with a Silicon Valley engineer shopping at a Costco.
Here's the chocolate cake, all American chocolate. This cake is about 7 inches high, and I can go through a cake like this in about a day. I think we'll go get some fruit next.
If you Google Hank Magnuski, you'll learn he's kind of a big deal in telecommunications. But that's not going to matter to the people he's shopping for.
Bananas have a lot of nutrients. It's a favorite hiker food.
After he leaves, he'll head out to the Pacific Crest Trail, known as the PCT, and wait for a herd of hikers. They won't know about his Silicon Valley life. They'll know him mostly by his trail name, the Owl, a nickname he received for his pensive personality. And they'll remember him as the guy who greeted them with the first indulgent desserts and fresh fruits they'd seen in hundreds of miles. While Magnuski shops, unsuspecting hikers trek a really beautiful but tough patch of the PCT, south of the Sonora Pass. It's deep wilderness. Within a 300-mile stretch, there's only one road, Yosemite's Highway 120, which crosses the PCT. For a week, hikers scale a steep pass every day, facing swarms of mosquitoes, unpredictable weather, and snow, even in this drought year.
Calling, come on, you sweet old girl.
This is Shannon Pepper.
Shannon Pepper, a.k.a. Pan, from Missoula, Montana.
Hard times ain't gonna rule my mind no more.
The recent college graduate sings to lift her spirits on the trail. Pan says hikers typically leave the trail every 5 days or so to shower and restock their food. It's mostly dried and dehydrated to keep their packs light.
When you're on trail and you're carrying all of your own meals, it can get really scary when you are close to being out. And I feel like I have a little better perspective on what it really means to be hungry. We live in a society of plenty, and there isn't plenty when you have to carry all of it.
The whole herd.
But plenty is what Pan finds when she walks into a picnic area where Hank Magnuski is waiting with a table full of all of that food from Costco.
I'm the Owl. I'm your host here.
Oh, wonderful.
Help yourself.
This is the Sonora Pass Cafe. Magnuski sets it up one or two weekends every summer when he knows there will be a lot of PCT traffic. In 3 days, 50 hikers come through with trail names like Gotta Walk, Pesky, Laugh Track, and Park. None of them expected this.
Oh, I just got a cookie with a cherry on top. Magic.
Cookie selfies, cookie guys. Selfies.
Where is my camera? I'm missing.
That was it.
We have the classic oilcloth tablecloth with beautiful, like, fresh fruit.
He's got delicious beer.
There's a chocolate cake that you can't even imagine on the trail.
Also Wi-Fi. Yeah. So currently I'm blogging.
Magnuski brings china and camping chairs and newspapers. On a nearby tree, he hangs a dartboard he calls Hiker's Revenge.
That is totally a mosquito on the dartboard. All right, I'm going to stick it to you for sticking it to me.
Magnuski doesn't say much, but he smiles broadly as he brews up gourmet coffee on a portable stove.
The PCT folks are doing 25 miles a day. It's like a marathon every single day for 6 months. And Trail Magic helps alleviate the pain.
Trail Magic. That's any serendipitous help or treat offered to PCT hikers. Trail Angels provide water or free rides or hiker-friendly food, like what Magnuski serves at the Sonora Pass Cafe. He considers it an honor to be out here. He discovered the Sierras nearly 20 years ago, chaperoning his son's Boy Scout trips.
I grew to love the mountains. It's really my cathedral out here. And I got involved in trail work after he went to college and I had nobody to hike with.
Magnuski joined a trail crew maintaining this section of the PCT and realized how barren the Sonora Pass is, even this picnic area.
There's nothing here but trees and a privy. The thought of a full-blown cafe in the middle of the wilderness just seemed like a neat idea.
So 10 years ago, he hosted his first Sonora Pass Cafe here.
Here comes the cookie.
There you go.
Ah, nice.
Kat Addison, trail name Cat Dog, is from Bend, Oregon. She hasn't come down off the trail to rest or replenish her pack in 9 days.
When I got to the trailhead, I saw this little sign that there was Trail Magic. I started to cry because I was so tired. So I'm so glad to be here.
Addison's 62. A decade ago, she hiked the Appalachian Trail, but she's hiking the entire PCT for the first time.
The Sierras have kicked me around a little bit. I mean, I've had a couple meltdowns. I've had a couple face plants. Didn't feel too good. You know, people always say the trail provides, and sometimes it does.
Whipped cream on top.
Gage Waffle nearly ran out of food on the trail and is gorging on whipped cream, cake, and carrots. He's from Tulsa, Oklahoma, in his 20s, and he was working on a gas pipeline when a buddy called and proposed they hike the trail together.
I didn't ask any questions, I just said, I'm in.
But 3 weeks before their start date, his friend backed out.
So I decided to come alone. I'd never really done anything or been out on any adventure on my own before. So I was a little bit terrified at first. And this whole experience is just taking all of that away. And allowed me to not worry about the things that could go wrong, but just enjoy what's going right. Like this right here at Sonora Pass.
Now, there's color in the cheeks and light in the eyes of the hikers as they throw on their packs and head out for a few more hours on the trail.
Congratulations on that 1,000 miles. That's your last 10,000-foot peak up there. And it's all downhill from there.
To the Columbia River?
To the Columbia River, that's right.
At the Sonora Pass, I'm Lisa Morehouse for Cross Currents.
California Foodways is made possible with support from Cal Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. You can visit them at calhum.org. Vicki Lee did additional reporting for this piece. You can subscribe to the podcast. Search California Foodways at your favorite podcast provider. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now it's time for your stories. This is San Francisco's StoryCorps. California's most destructive fire, the Tubbs Wildfire, incinerated almost 37,000 acres in Northern California. The city of Santa Rosa was one of the largest affected and lost nearly 3,000 homes. That's about 5% of the houses in town. Jessica Stillman and Amanda Aboud are counselors at the Verity Crisis Center in Santa Rosa. In this interview, they talk about how hard it was to leave Santa Rosa during the fires instead of staying to help counsel at shelters and the ways they cope with the weight of their patients' traumas and their own.
And then as we were driving out of town, you know, listening to the radio, they put out like a call for like, if you have training and like, if you know how to help people through like trauma and crises, like we really need you. And I just like burst into tears and I'm driving away. Like it was so hard.
When the Santa Rosa fire hit, it gave me a really bigger appreciation of who we work with, especially their trauma and their and this being able to do basic things, because that's really what I'm supporting them on. When the fire hit, I had to evacuate. And during that evacuation time, I could not do basic things. Like, I couldn't plan for myself.
Yeah, I mean, in the therapist community, we talk about how there's a correlation between your level of, like, alarm and arousal and the amount of time into the future that you're able to like think and plan. So if you're in like a calm, relaxed state, you can plan, you know, what you're going to do next week. And if you're feeling a little nervous, then you can think about maybe what you're going to have for dinner. And if you're in like a traumatized, alert state, it's like you're either in the present moment or like, you know, 2 minutes into the future. And so I, you know, it's really interesting how you take your experience from that and apply it to, oh, I'm meeting with people who are in this state constantly. We decided to leave and go visit my family down south, and it was a really hard decision. I felt very guilty. I felt like I should be in the shelters volunteering because I have a lot of knowledge about coping with trauma and crises, and felt like that was valuable knowledge to share. But I had a 2-year-old and I'm pregnant. And so I couldn't be out breathing the air. Like I just couldn't. And then as we were driving out of town, you know, listening to the radio, which was on, they put out like a call for like, if you have training and like, if you know how to help people through like trauma and crises, like we really need you. And I just like burst into tears of like, and I'm driving away. Like it was so hard.
Was there something you, like for myself, I took, I bought my friend a princess dress. And so when I evacuated, I was going to San Diego for a bachelorette party. So I grabbed the silliest like bachelorette stuff and then I grabbed a princess dress. Was there anything silly you grabbed just when you left?
Yeah. And there was like a list going around, right? Of like the silliest thing you took. I grabbed pretty like sensible stuff. It was a pretty good backer. You know, for me, it was what I didn't take. My first child passed away. And I have her urn. And I forgot to bring it. And I remembered when we were, like, you know, 2 hours out of town. And I just turned to my husband and said, oh, my God, like, we forgot Luna. We forgot Luna's urn. And I just burst into tears. And he was like, yeah, I know, I remembered. About an hour ago and like didn't want to say anything until you remembered. And it was going to be the last thing I grabbed and then, you know, just didn't. And that really, that was hard because I just thought like, how could I forget her? I like to talk a lot about like with trauma, like digesting or metabolizing it, that we don't want to just turn away from it. It's overwhelming sometimes to face it. We don't want to just hold it and shove it down. You know, the only way out is through. And so how can we compost it? How can we turn it into some sort of, you know, useful energy that can give us some post-traumatic growth instead of just post-traumatic stress?
Amanda Aboud and Jessica Stillman shared their story with San Francisco StoryCorps. That piece was produced by Mary Franklin Harvin. The rest of our Cross Currents team today includes Janae Darden, Nina Gensler-Debs, Emma McAvoy, Mira Nabulsi, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Marco Seiler-Gonzalez, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Ren Geisick. The San Jose native will be playing the second birthday bash at Black Cat in San Francisco tomorrow night. Her set starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. And I guess I know.